Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're getting into a really tough, really important topic, the evolving threat of terrorism, and crucially, how we respond to it. Yeah, looking at our sources, the picture's pretty stark. The threat from political extremists, well, it's shot up over the past decade, especially in the West, North America, Europe, Australia. So our job today, cut through the jargon, really define what we're talking about, look at the motivations, which are pretty varied, and then tackle the complexities of WMDs, weapons of mass destruction.
Exactly. And starting with definitions is key. Terrorism, at its core, it's violence. Unlawful violence against innocent people, specifically aimed at achieving, you know, political or social aims. It's about creating fear.
And that fear comes from the randomness, right? They don't always pick obvious targets.
That's a big part of it. Terrorists often don't discriminate much. Attacks can, and sadly do, happen almost anywhere on the globe.
And the sources draw a line between two main types, which really shapes the response. You've got international terrorism, that's acts by foreign groups or agents. Often big cities, yeah, but not always. We've seen attacks in suburbs, even rural spots.
Right. And then there's domestic terrorism. This stuff originates within the country itself. The example everyone points to is Oklahoma City in 95, the Murrah Federal Building bombing.
Chilling example.
It really showed, tragically, that the threat can be homegrown. And often aimed right at government symbols, not just random crowds, it changes the dynamic entirely.
So it's not just looking outward, but inward, too. A fragmented threat. Okay, let's dive into the why, the motivations.
It's a surprisingly wide range. And what really stands out is most attacks aren't just one person.
No, usually not. It often takes several people working together. That implies some kind of organization, some structure, even if the ideology driving them is, you know, way out there.
So how do we categorize these motivations? Helps to understand what we're up against. It does. It helps move from just feeling anxious about it to actually thinking strategically. Different motives mean different enemies, different tactics needed. So first off, you've got state terrorists. This is when a government itself uses terror tactics systematically against its own people to control them. State-sponsored violence turned inward.
Okay, then there are the religious extremists. Their goals seem bigger, almost apocalyptic sometimes.
Often, yeah. They might be seeking mass murder, really large-scale violence, driven by a belief, however warped, that they need to cleanse an area of people who don't share their specific faith. The scale they aim for can be huge.
A stark contrast to the political extremists, maybe, though they use violence too.
Right. Both ends of the spectrum, left and right, can resort to violence, but they tend to target different things. Right-wing extremists often aim to preserve what they see as traditional social orders, maybe limit government power.
Whereas left-wing extremists might target corporations, big business interests, trying to overturn the established structures they disagree with.
Exactly. Okay. Hitting the financial or corporate centers. Then you have issue-oriented groups. Think anti-abortion violence or some eco-terrorist act.
Using violence for a very specific cause.
Precisely. And what's tricky here is they can sometimes be the violent fringe of a much larger, mostly nonviolent movement. Makes them kind of unpredictable.
And there are others too, right? Separatists?
Yep. Separatists fighting for political or economic freedom for their group. Narco-terrorists using terror tactics to control drug routes or territories. And then, maybe the scariest, pathologic terrorists.
You meaning?
Meaning there's no real political or religious goal you can point to. It's just about the desire to control, to inflict terror for its own sake.
Wow. Okay, so the main point here is the threat isn't monolithic, it's fragmented. Lots of different potential sources and reasons.
Which means our awareness, our vigilance has to be just as broad.
Makes sense. Okay, moving to how these attacks happen. They're usually covert, planned in secret, and the target selection, it seems deliberately cruel. Not just about damage, but maximizing that fear response.
Absolutely. High-value targets are picked for shock value, maximum disruption. Responders learn to recognize patterns. Events with large crowds, obviously. Locations that trigger deep fear, like maybe schools or hospitals. Critical infrastructure is huge, too.
Like transportation networks, power grids, industry.
All of that. Plus, locations with symbolic importance. But here's one that catches people off guard. They sometimes target emergency response facilities themselves.
Hitting a police station, a fire department command post.
Yeah. Think about it. It's designed to cripple the very system that's meant to help. It's a strategic move to sow chaos.
Okay, that's sobering. So being prepared starts way before anything happens. You mentioned the NTAS system.
Right, the National Terrorism Advisory System. It gives alerts. Two main levels you need to know. Elevated alert means there's a credible threat, but maybe not specific on timing or target. An imminent alert, though, that means something specific, credible, and expected very soon.
So, let's put ourselves on the ground. You're a first responder. You arrive at a scene, maybe an explosion, maybe just something feels wrong. What are those first flags?
You're looking for things that don't add up. Pre-incident indicators.
Mm.
What type of location is it? Why this place? Is the number of patients way higher than you'd expect for, say, a small fire? And critically, what are the victims saying?
Victim statements.
Huge. If multiple people suddenly collapse saying they smelled almonds or bleach or noticed a weird mist, that screams potential chemical agent. You have to listen.
Okay, so if an attack is suspected, big explosion, people dropping with breathing problems, what are the absolute first steps, top priorities?
Safety. Yours first, then the scenes, always. Get on the radio immediately, notify dispatch, tell your supervisor, and request backup early, especially specialized teams like hazmat.
Better to have them rolling and cancel than need them and wait.
Exactly. You can always stand them down.
Yeah.
You can't get that response time back. Then establish incident command, get organized, and kickstart your mass casualty procedures right away.
And that scene, safety point, it's critical.
Yeah.
In these kinds of situations, rushing in could be fatal for the rescuer.
Absolutely. If a scene looks unsafe, you see a vapor cloud, people are twitching or seizing the rule as ironclad, You do not go in unprepared. You wait for the trained, properly equipped teams.
And if you're setting up a staging area for incoming units.
Best practice is always upwind and uphill from the incident. Keep personnel and vehicles out of any potential plume or runoff. The real danger in these WMD events, besides the agent itself, is the stress. It can cause tunnel vision.
Focusing only on the patient right in front of you, ignoring the bigger picture.
Yeah, ignoring the signs of a spreading chemical cloud or maybe another device. Situational awareness is everything. You have to constantly reassess.
And with chemical or biological stuff, the best defense isn't necessarily fancy medicine later. It's just not getting exposed in the first place.
That's the core principle. The best protection is preventing contact. The two biggest threats operationally are contamination, getting the agent on you or a victim, and cross-contamination.
Meaning spreading it.
Exactly. Cracking it from the hot zone to the cold zone, onto equipment, into ambulances, into the hospital. It can shut down the whole medical system if you're not careful.
Which brings us to a really nasty tactic, the secondary device. Explain that.
It's a horrible tactic. Terrorists plant a second bomb, sometimes hidden, time to go off after the first one to target the responders. The police, fire, paramedics rushing in to help after the first blast. It weaponizes our instinct to help.
So that forces responders to be even more cautious. Slow down.
It has to. You can't assume a scene is safe just because the first event is over. You must constantly reassess for hidden threats, other devices. It changes the whole approach.
Yeah.
The first paramedic on scene, their job isn't just patient care initially. It's establishing the medical command structure, figuring out how big this thing is, getting info out, and assigning roles, decontamination, triage, treatment, transport leads. And expect cops, lots of them. You work with law enforcement, follow their lead on scene security.
Right. Okay, this is a good point to shift into the WMDs themselves. These devices designed for mass death, casualties, huge damage. We use that acronym, CBRNE.
Yeah, it's a handy way to categorize them. Chemical, biologic, radiologic, nuclear, and explosive. Let's start with chemical agents. These are man-made nasties. Liquids, powders, vapors, designed for immediate harm. And we break those down further by how they work. Like blister agents, vesicants, they mainly get you through the skin, cause these awful burn-like blisters. Mustard gas is the infamous one, no real antidote for it. Lewisite, another one, does have an antidote, BAL. But if you breathe these in, severe cough, coughing up blood, bad news for the lungs.
Okay, then there are choking agents, like chlorine.
Yeah, right, or pulmonary agents. They go straight for the respiratory system, damage the lungs, make them leak fluid. Victims essentially drown from the inside. Chlorine's a big concern because it's common industrially, easy to get, relatively.
Yeah. Any telltale signs?
Yeah, chlorine has that distinct bleach smell, can create a greenish haze. And like mustard, no specific antidote. It's all about aggressive respiratory support.
But the ones really designed brutally just for killing lots of people quickly, nerve agents.
Yeah, these are organophosphates. Things like sarin, usually denoted GB, and then VX, which is terrifyingly potent, like 100 times more lethal than sarin. They work by blocking an enzyme called cholinesterase.
What does that do?
Cholinesterase basically regulates nerve signals. When it's blocked, the nerves just keep firing uncontrollably. Muscles spasm, glands pour out secretions, breathing stops.
Mm-hmm.
The body's organs effectively burn themselves out in minutes. It's incredibly rapid and deadly.
And our sources mentioned something even newer, potentially worse. Novichok. How does that compare to something like VX?
Novichok.
Yeah.
That's a major concern. VX is already incredibly deadly, but Novichok agents, from what we understand, they might be even more potent, maybe 5 times VX. But the bigger issue is they're reportedly designed to be harder to detect with standard equipment, and they can persist in the environment for longer.
So harder to know you're walking into it?
Potentially, yes. It raises huge challenges for first responders. You might not get that immediate warning sign you'd get with, say, chlorine smell.
Okay, moving from the immediate chemical threat to something sneakier, biologic agents.
Right, these are living organisms, viruses, bacteria, or toxins derived from them, deliberately cultivated to cause disease or death on a mass scale.
And the big problem here is detection.
Right. It's monumental. Biologic agents can be totally invisible, odorless, tasteless. You might not know an attack has happened until days or weeks later when people start getting sick. And the symptoms often look just like the flu or some other common illness at first.
So how do responders even track this?
2 key factors become critical. Communicability, how easily does it spread from person to person? And incubation period, how long between exposure and symptoms? Short incubation means a fast, localized disaster. Long incubation. That's terrifying too, because it could spread worldwide before anyone realizes what's happening.
What are some of the main biological threats we need to think about?
Well, you have viruses. Smallpox is a classic bioterror concern, highly contagious, distinctive rash. The vaccine isn't widely available, generally just for certain responders, because it has risks itself. Then you have things like viral hemorrhagic fevers, VHFs. Ebola is the most famous. They cause the body to basically lose its ability to clot. Blood can seep out from tissues. Horrific. Then bacteria. Anthrax is a big one. It forms spores, tough little things that can survive for ages. You can get it through inhalation, on the skin, or by eating contaminated food.
Mm.
But maybe the most worrying bacterial threat is plague.
Plague. Like the Black Death.
The very same bacteria, Yersinia pestis. But it matters how it presents. Bubonic plague, the classic form with swollen lymph nodes or buboes, isn't usually contagious person to person. But pneumonic plague infects the lungs. That form is highly contagious through respiratory droplets. It's easier to spread as a weapon and much deadlier if not treated fast.
Okay. And then biotoxins. You mentioned ricin.
Yeah, ricin is fascinatingly scary. It comes from the castor bean plant, specifically the waste mash left over after making castor oil. Pre-gone stuff.
But the toxin itself.
Highly potent. It gets inside your cells and shuts down protein production. If inhaled, it causes severe lung damage, fluid buildup, circulatory collapse. Treatment is just supportive care. And then there's botulinum toxin.
And botulism.
Exactly. Produced by the Clostridium botulinum bacteria. It's considered perhaps the single most poisonous substance known. It causes muscle paralysis, starting usually with the face and eyes, then moving down. Eventually paralyzes the respiratory muscles, leads to respiratory arrest if not treated with antitoxin and ventilation.
Just incredible potency from natural sources. Okay, let's quickly round out CBRNE, radiologic, and nuclear.
Right, radiologic threats involve radioactive materials. The most talked about terrorist scenario isn't usually a full nuclear bomb, but a radiologic dispersal device, or RDD, a dirty bomb.
So not a nuclear explosion?
No, not at all. It uses conventional explosives, dynamite, C4, whatever, packed with radioactive material. The bomb itself causes the immediate blast damage. The radioactive stuff just gets scattered. The real weapon there isn't the explosion's force. It's the long-term contamination, the panic, the cost of cleanup.
And protection comes down to some basic principles.
Very basic, but crucial. Time, distance, and shielding. Minimize your time near the source. Maximize your distance from it, and put as much dense material shielding between you and it as possible. Concrete, lead, even just earth helps. And remember, being exposed to radiation doesn't make you radioactive. Contamination only happens if the radioactive dust or particles are on you.
Which means decontamination is key before medical treatment.
Absolutely essential. Get the material off before bringing the patient into a clean area or hospital. Nuclear weapons themselves are a whole different scale. Obviously incredibly destructive. Thankfully, much harder for non-state actors to acquire or build.
And finally, the E in CBRNE. Explosives. You said these are the most common?
By far. They're accessible, relatively easy to make compared to nerve gas or refining plutonium, and they work.
Hmm.
They cause immediate visible destruction and casualties. We see simple package IEDs, improvised explosive devices like pipe bombs, often packed with shrapnel nails, nuts, bolts to cause more injuries, sometimes even with small amounts of chemical agents added.
Vehicle bombs, too?
Yep. VBIEDs, vehicle-borne IEDs, can carry much larger explosive charges, often using things like ammonium nitrate fertilizer mixed with fuel oil. Devastating potential. And then suicide bombs.
Low cost, high impact.
Tragically, yes.
Yeah.
Combines the explosive power with the, well, the precision guidance of a human being willing to die. Allows for timing and placement that might be difficult otherwise. Very effective, very hard to stop.
So wrapping this all up, we've covered everything from fringe political groups to these incredibly sophisticated, sometimes invisible weapons. What's the bottom line for readiness?
It really boils down to systematic training, constant situational awareness, and strict adherence to safety protocols. Whether it's a bomb blast scene or a suspected nerve agent release, the fundamental rule holds. Ensure safety, manage the scene methodically, and remember, decontamination always comes before definitive medical treatment. If you don't control contamination, you risk paralyzing the entire response system.
So our main takeaway for you, the listener, yeah, the threat landscape is huge, it's diverse. But being able to categorize those motivations, state, religious, political, issue-based, and understanding the basic differences between the five classes of WMV chemical, biologic, radiologic, nuclear, explosive, that's the first essential step. It gives you a framework, helps you gain perspective, and maybe feel a bit less overwhelmed by it all.
And that leads to maybe one final thought to leave you with. Consider this. We know biologic agents can be virtually undetectable, their symptoms mimicking everyday sicknesses. We also know that the chaos of any major incident can really cloud judgment. So how much more critical does something like systematic syndromic surveillance become? You know, public health, actively looking for unusual patterns and reported illnesses, a spike in flu-like symptoms way out of season, for example, especially when you factor in the worried well, people who aren't sick but flood clinics out of fear after an event. Managing that fear, which can overwhelm resources just as badly as the agent itself, maybe that's the ultimate challenge because that fear is often exactly what the terrorists want to achieve.